suggestions on the Bird Talk Radio. If your bird's misbehaving, we'll help you save it on the Bird Talk Radio. If your bird's getting rowdy, just call and say howdy on the Bird Talk Radio. We are birds of a feather, we'll stick together on the Bird Talk Radio.
Come on and listen, we got suggestions on the Bird Talk Radio. If your bird's misbehaving, we'll help you save it on the Bird Talk Radio. If your bird's getting rowdy, just call and say howdy on the Bird Talk Radio. We are birds of a feather, we'll stick together on the Bird Talk Radio.
Are you searching for the healthiest, most wholesome food for your parrots? Then you've got to take a look at Topps Parrot Food. Topps has been around since 2003 and is now USDA organic certified. Topps is the only parrot food company that can use the USDA organic mark and does not use any fillers like peanuts, corn, or soy, or artificial flavors or colors. The food is all natural, non-GMO, and made with all organic ingredients to keep your birds happy and healthy. We all want that. Topps is also made right here in the United States. So stop feeding your parrots sugar, artificial colors, and fillers like peanuts. Switch to Topps Parrot Food, USDA organic certified, non-GMO, and made in the U.S. Visit www.toppsparrotfood.com to order the best organic pellets, seed mixes, and treats. And here's an added bonus for you. Use code BTR18 at checkout to save $5 on your next order. That's BTR, like Bird Talk Radio, 18 to save $5. Topps Parrot Food, TOPSparrotfood.com. USDA organic, and the birds love it.
Wings of Love bird shows are educational and fun for the entire family. Wings of Love bird show birds answer questions, spell words, ride bicycles, play basketball, roller skate, and more. Plus, you'll experience Swoop, the Eurasian eagle owl, swooping over the audience. Visit wingsofloveinc.org. That's wingsofloveinc.org for more information about these exciting shows. Find out how you can have Wings of Love at your event and the show schedules.
Bird Talk radio hosts and Bird Talk Live Online, a live call-in talk radio show produced live from our studio in Kansas City. Individual bird owners and avian professionals share their experiences live on air. We talk about parrots, cockatoos, conures, and many species of pet birds, bird diet, health, and behavior issues discussed during our Bird Talk radio shows, as well as individual unique experiences. Our guest speakers have their feathered loved one. You could be the next guest speaker on Bird Talk Live Online, the world leader in aviculture talk radio. Enjoy our ever-popular Bird Talk radio shows, sharing the bird love worldwide 24 hours per day, 7 days per week, and 365 days per year from our streaming show server and podcast networks. Visit birdtalkradio.com to access links to our very popular Bird Talk radio shows, to find information about how your business may benefit from our large audience. Thank you for tuning in to Bird Talk Radio today. Yay!
I'm your host, Michael Kiger of Bird Talk Radio, recorded live from Kansas City. I hope you enjoy our premiere on the Voice America Variety Channel Saturdays at 3 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 p.m. Central, and 6 p.m. Eastern. Co-host Ginger Duplessis opens the door for listeners to become interested in and further their own study and practice of the force-free positive reinforcement pet bird training method. Visit birdtalkradio.com for more information, and thank you for tuning in today. Ginger is an adjunct staff member of Oasis Sanctuary Arizona, a Humane Society of Arizona partner, American Federation of Aviculture Certified Aviculturist. She has completed levels 1 and 2 with the AFA in aviculture training, and a 2012 graduate of Susan Friedman Behavior Works Program, which is really great, listening audience. I googled up Susan Friedman, never seen her work, But before the show, I did my homework, and this is a really great website to look at and person to go to for some aviculture behavior training. And Ginger has completed some training with the Susan Friedman organization. This is Dr. Susan Friedman, psychology professor at Utah State, who pioneered application of applied behavior analysis to captive and companion animals. And Ginger has been sharing with us about this behavior training from her education and experience, and some really great experience, and she's learned a lot, and she knows a lot of specific things about behavior training, specifically with positive reinforcement that we've been enjoying here. And could you kind of recap this, Ginger, for the listening audience, about the training, could you explain that basic example again of positive reinforcement you did with the pistachio and the rope ring? Sure. and that kind of thing? Could we go back there, and then we'll cover a couple more things so we can get this on the recording for the podcast?
Sure, you bet. So basically what we were talking about before is what do I do with a brand new bird that walks in the door when I'm trying to train them and get them used to being here in this new environment? And how do I give them some kind of a skill to understand what I want from them and understand a language, something we can communicate? How do we communicate? So I use positive reinforcement for that. The way to do that is to find out what's a motivator for that animal. And typically, the birds are motivated by food. So what I'll do is, an example I gave, and we can talk about again, is a parrot that was a wild caught parrot. Came into me totally scared, afraid of everything, and especially him. So what we would do is give him, outside of his normal diet consisted of pellets and fresh vegetables. But outside of that, what does he favor? So I gave him a bowl, and I put some seed in it, and the seed I put in it is sunflower seed, for example, and some pistachio nuts. And I went to see what he would eat out of that. And he went for the pistachio nuts every time. So that I knew then was his favorite treat. That was the thing that he really wanted. So I removed that completely from everything I ever did with that bird unless I wanted to train him. And training is really simple. People think of training as something that's structured. But every time that you are doing something with your bird, you are training them, whether it's a positive or negative thing. You don't know you're training them, but you are. So think about it that way.
That is interesting. Right, because they're picking up on whatever you do, whether it's positive or negative, right?
That's right. Every single thing you do, you're training your bird. So even the way you take the bowls out of the bird cage, if you have the ability to do that through one of the little feeder doors that most of the parrots cages have, you're still training your bird to do something. Now, is he, you know, rushing at the bowl, trying to attack the bowl while you're taking it out, and you're still doing it, then you're training him it's okay to do that. So that's another issue we can address. But you're training your bird in everything you do when you interact with them. So it's something to keep in mind. So in this case, what I did with this bird, his name is Victor. And so Victor, every time I would do anything with him, I would just take a platform perch, which is a flat perch. It's very easy to put on the very front of the cage. I put it on his cage door just because it was easier for me. And every day I would put a pistachio nut on top of that platform perch and just go about my business in the bird room. He soon learned that I was paired then with that nut. So he started looking forward to me coming around to give him that nut, because he knew when I would come by his cage, he was going to get that. So slowly but surely, he would come closer and closer to get that nut. So the first few interactions like that, what I would do is put the nut there and leave. The next time I would put the nut there and he'd take a step toward me, and I was keeping up there, I'm sorry, and hold on to it. When he would take a step toward me, I would let go and just go away and do my thing and let him go get the nut. So think about the increments that it would take for him to get all the way across his cage, 30 inches, and get that nut. Eventually, he learned to take it from my hand. And how he did that is it was a high enough motivator. That was the only time he would get a pistachio, one time a day. He wanted it so bad that he just came over there and stood on that perch and took it gently from my hand. And that was the start of everything else. Because all he had to learn was that I was not going to do anything to him with my hand. My hand was simply the deliverer of the treat. That's it. Mm-hmm. It never did anything more. And so by doing that, it gave him that communication. Now, I translated that into doing some other things. Here at the rescue, I do all of the paper on the top of the grate. I use white paper and not newspaper. I do that so I can look at the droppings to determine what they look like for health issues and to watch for things like that. Also, Senegal parrots like to play on the bottom of the cage. Mm-hmm. So they can see their poop and they're not standing in it. So in order to change the paper in the cage, I would have to open the door, obviously, and put my hands in the cage. Well, Victor wasn't ready for that stage at the very beginning. So I used to put the paper underneath like everybody else does in the paper tray. Mm. All right, so what I would do is now that he was used to getting that treat, I had him come get the treat, and he would take it to the back of his cage, which just was his custom anyway, and eat it. So then I opened the door. I didn't do anything at first. I just opened the door, closed the door. He was like, oh, you just opened and closed the door. You didn't do anything. That's interesting, but I still got my treat, and I'm happy. Next day, I opened the door a little longer. The next day, a little longer. The next day, I put my hand on the inside on top of the grate and then just took it off. So slowly, we built up to me putting in the paper on the bottom on the grate. And he was like, okay. He got his nut. He knew I wasn't going to do anything to him. It was a slow progression. It didn't take, 2 days. Like a lot of people are used to wanting the instant gratification of, I want to train this bird and give him a nut and have him sit in the corner and I get to do my stuff. And it's like, eventually, right. Yeah. And you're going to be able to do that if you work with the bird within their time. You watch the bird. You watch for their language. If they're dropping the nut, it's too quick. Back up a step. So if you give them a nut and they drop it because they're like totally unsure what you're going to do, they're nervous, they're scared, they're apprehensive, not good timing. Stop what you were doing and back up a step. Get them back into being comfortable with it. So this is the kind of thing I do with these birds. Is we do slow progression and small increments, and it's all about positive reinforcement.
And what about we talked about clicker training.
Yes. So I used to use clickers all the time. I still do sometimes with some of the birds that I taught in the beginning. But clickers have some good and some bad. Clickers have their place. Some birds are afraid of them because they're pretty loud. They do make a puppy clicker, which is a little bit softer in tone and not so scary. But what I have found is I just use the word good. So when they do something, I'll just say good as the marker. They call it a bridge to say this was what I expected, and then I give them a treat. So I'm marking the behavior with the word good in a very distinct way and immediately delivering them the treat, and it has to be immediate. So you can't be fumbling around, and that's where a lot of people fall into the clicker being a problem because they're fumbling around with their fingers, right? Trying to hold on to the clicker and hold on to the treat and hold on. It's hard for some people. It's a lot easier to just say a word.
So use the word instead of the clicker.
Correct. So here's an example of what I would do.
No, go ahead. Mm-hmm. No, go ahead. I was thinking of something else, but I don't want to interrupt you.
Oh, okay. Thank you. So what I would do is if I want a bird to do something when they're doing it, the minute they do it, I say good and give them a treat immediately. So they, and it ties in real fast to what they're doing. And the treat has to be the highly motivated treat, the one that they favor, the one that's of highest value and held out of everything else they ever get. They cannot get that treat for anything else.
Right. And can you explain again how you arrive at what treat to use?
So what I'll do is sometimes I'll take a dish, a plate. It depends on the bird. If the bird's not tame, like in Victor's case, a wild caught Senegal, it wouldn't be harder. I just gave him a bowl, and I put two or maybe three or four different kinds of things in there that are considered treats. So that would be, because my birds don't get anything except pellets and veggies, it would be seed, it would be a nut. So I might put a couple sunflower seeds, a couple safflower seeds, maybe a nut or two in there, and just see what they go for and what's the consistent thing that they pick every time. And that becomes the highly valued food source, the high valued motivator, the one thing you hold out of their diet for everything else. And that's the one that you use for treats, for training treats. So that's okay. How you select that.
Okay.
Once you have that identified and you hold that back from their diet, you use that for everything, for motivation.
Okay. And can we move on to the Senegal parrot and the specific behavior of the parrot defending their own tree again in the wild, and how that works in captivity, once again, for a listening audience and for our recording for the podcast?
Certainly. So one thing to keep in mind about Senegal parrots is they are not flock-oriented birds. And what I mean by that is, if you think of macaws or African grays or conures or even cockatoos, they're just you see them in groups by the thousands in their native habitat. In the native habitat of a Senegal, you're not going to find anything like that because they live in separate trees. The trees are usually and typically located in the savanna, where they'll be in small groups of trees. And so they will descend to their territory, their tree, to the death. And that is just the way they are hardwired. They're not flock birds. You may see them if you were ever in Africa to see this. They're considered a pest by farmers there because they will congregate to eat together. But that does not mean they're flocking together. That's a whole different thing. So they don't go to what they do at night. When they flock, the flock birds will all go to the same trees and they'll all hang out together. And Senegals don't do that. They'll go to their tree that family group of maybe five or six hang out in, and that's it. And they will defend that tree because that's their life source. That's where they have their nesting. That's where they have their family group. That's where they raise their babies. That's where the pair bond is. And so when you take that kind of hardwiring and put it into captivity, you're taking a bird that is not flock-oriented and expecting it to get along with a flock. And that flock in captivity could be your family of five people, three kids and two mom, dad. It could be a husband and wife, and now we're a flock of three with the Senegal. Or it could be someone who has macaws and Senegal and, you know, conures and a whole bunch of other birds. And now they want a Senegal to behave like the other flock birds, and it's not going to happen. Senegals get the territorial nature built in, hardwired from the wild, and are considered aggressive birds then, therefore, because of the way they behave in a family environment, in captivity. So can that be changed? Yes. How do we change that? We can change it to this extent. Behaviorally, we can train them. We can't change it completely. It's always going to be there. So it's going to be up to us to understand that underlying hardwired part of them and to make it a successful home environment and captivity for them. And training is key with a Senegal parrot especially. It's just the way it is. Their pair bonds run very strong, and I know that their pair bonds, when it comes to human pair bonds, their pair bonds can be to the point where they attack one person over another. Or they also deliver something called replacement biting, which some other parrots can do too, but it's very high in genitals. And that is, again, same thing with the tree. Think about the tree. Here's this tree, and we've got five genitals, and they're all part of the same group, family group. And a new guy comes in, and he says, hey, I like that girl. All of a sudden, the pair bond's going to bite the girl genital to keep her away from the intruder. So he's going to become in between those two. And that's where you get displacement bites. And that happens a lot with genitals. So owners will constantly contact me, and they'll tell me, hey, you know, Ginger, I've had the genital for 5 years, and you know, he's been doing great, and everything's fine, but I have a boyfriend now, and he attacks me when my boyfriend comes in. But he doesn't even like my boyfriend. Why is that happening?
Gender-specific issues, right.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, there's a lot going on there. It happens to be, you know, a lot of the, most of that kind of a thing has to do with the genital.
Because of the close bonding with the original owner or person that adopts.
Now here's, right. And here's another thing. I don't know that this happens too much with other parrots. I've not heard of as much. But Senegals do change allegiance from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
So I have heard of people all of a sudden, you know, that their bird was bonded to them for years, and all of a sudden now the husband who's lived there his whole life too now becomes the favored person, and all of a sudden the, you know, the original owner is no longer the favored person. And that tends to happen too. So yeah, there's a lot of dynamics with Senegals that are pretty incredible and species specific, which is what I do like, because I'm learning about them more and more all the time.
It is interesting.
And I like helping. Yeah, I like helping.
Well, the gender specific, the gender issues I know are, I mean, broad and wide among probably a lot of medium and large sized parrots. I don't think I've seen gender specific problems with smaller birds like parakeets and conures. But when you get a little larger, like the Senegals, you have a higher intellect. And of course, and knowing about how they are in the wild, they're more individual birds, not community birds. And I'm just thinking about this from my experience grooming people's birds and doing a little bit of behavior training over long time working with birds over 30 years. However, you know, most of my behavior training is has been oriented with getting a bird calm enough to groom them, you know, trim their wings, toenails, and beak, which is really just a matter of, you know, can I get you to hold still? There's not much science to it.
Yep. It's more about the flooding thing like we talked about before.
Right,
you know,
right. Is there some way I can get you to hold still long enough to lop off your toenails and your and a few of your flight feathers so you can't fly up in a ceiling fan?
Right. Right. So there's those kinds of things too. It's a different way of training, and you know, it's all about training. I mean, everything's training. But let me just make one thing clear that maybe I didn't make clear about the gender issue. Senegals don't have a specific gender that they're attracted to. In other words, a male Senegal isn't going to fall in love with a female human, or vice versa. I have a lot of Senegals here that are bonded only to me that are females. I have a lot of male Senegals that are only bonded to my husband, because he interacts with the birds a lot too, that are males. So it's a different kind of thing. It's not like you would think. I do have some birds, though, that I have had come to me that were, when they are arriving, they'll give me the bird and they say, this bird hates women. I'm like, okay, good to know.
I'm laughing because I've seen a lot of this in my grooming.
Yeah.
I used to do a lot of bird grooming, and even did some mobile grooming service. And I'm laughing because I've heard this so many times, and all these stories.
Sure.
you know, my bird hates men or my bird hates women, he bites my husband.
Give your bird the healthiest food on the market by switching to Tops Parrot Food. Tops is now USDA organic certified. That's right, Tops is certified organic, non-GMO, and does not use any fillers like corn, soy, or peanuts. No other brand can say that, and Tops is made in the USA. Check out Tops organic pellets, seed mixes, and treats at www.topsparrotfood.com. Give Tops a try today to keep your companions happy and healthy. Use code BTR18 at checkout to save $5 on your next order. That's BTR, like Bird Talk Radio, 18 to save $5. Tops Parrot Food, T-O-P-S, parrotfood.com. USDA organic, and the birds love it.
I'm laughing because I've heard this so many times and all these stories. And, you know, my bird hates men or my bird hates women. He bites my husband or he bites my wife. Yep.
And it's really more about the bird and the people that they, because we have to remember these guys are wild animals anyway. They're not domesticated like a dog or a cat. So they're wild and their instinct is very high. The motivation is high. They choose who they like. They just do. And it may not be a male Senegal choosing or a male parrot choosing a female human. They might choose a male human and say, I really kind of like this guy. And then that doesn't mean they like all males either. Male humans, I mean. So, you know, they're very specific. Parrots pick up on things. Their intelligence is very high, and they decide who they like and who they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where I was going with that. So
What about hand raising? Even Senegals, a person would be more successful with a younger bird if they actually want a Senegal. From my experience, hand feeding birds raises the bird up to be more tame, and they usually grow up, liking everybody. And even though they might bond with someone, they're still friendly with others.
So, no, in the beginning, all birds are like that. All hand-raised birds are like that. All baby birds are loving and wonderful and, cuddly and, all of the things that we all know about what a baby bird looks like when it's hand-reared, not parent-reared. And what will happen to a Senegal parrot, we have found, and this is something my avian vet helped me understand too, is that when they get to be about the age of two, they go through a stage called terrible twos, we call it, because we just need to name it something. So we just give it a label, terrible twos. So what's that mean? Well, in the wild, going back to the tree thing and thinking about how they live, at about the age of two is about the time adolescents are at the point of getting kicked out of their family group, especially the males too. And they have to go find their own tree. Well, at 2 years old, they know it's coming too. And they're starting to feel more independent, and they're starting to do more things and pushing the envelope in certain ways and things like that. That's still going to happen to that baby parrot that you had as a loving, cuddly little snuggle bug. All of a sudden, when he turns two, things start to change, and people go, oh, my gosh, what happened to my baby, my bird? He bites me now, and he bites my husband, or now he likes this person and he never liked him before. And, their behavior changes drastically. And this is typical of a Senegal parrot. Again, it's the non-flock mentality. It's the hardwiredness of not being in a big group. So the best thing you can do is train that baby when he's young by over-socializing him, which is very key. And I'm glad you brought that up as a point too, because take that baby everywhere. Everywhere, have everybody touch him, everybody play with him, everybody do everything with him so that he can continue to have that when he gets to that stage and you can still pass him off. But also training, especially from the year between one and two. I'm a high believer that in the first year of a bird's life, he should just be a bird. And what I mean by that is don't go into this whole thing about formal training necessarily to do tricks. Let them be a bird. You can still train them to do things, don't get me wrong.
Buddy Waski would love hearing you say that.
I think it's just so crucial.
And Tony Silva, right. Both of them have said the same thing, that we need to let these pet birds learn more about being a bird. Help them be a bird than a pet.
That's exactly, and I so totally believe that, especially after seeing all of the damage that can be done just by virtue of being a rescue and seeing what the leftovers have done, what, you know, what has happened over the years. I really think that if birds were left to be a bird, especially during the very first year when it's crucial in their development stages, it's the best thing you can do for that bird. It's the absolute very best thing you can do for them. They're learning to be independent. They're learning to be able to satisfy themselves, do things on their own. You're not coddling to them. There's just so much value in that. During the second year, from year one to year two, get them to do things with using communication skills, like I had mentioned before, with the food motivation and learning about hands and, you know, things like that, to the point where they understand there's a communication. Now we have a dialogue we can have. Now when I want you to do something, you'll know. If I give you this nut, you can go stand on the station, if you want to give it a formal name. People talk about stationing animals. Okay, here, give you your nut, Victor. Go sit on your perch over there and eat it, and I'll clean out your cage. That's stationing at its simplest, purest form. Mm-hmm. And it works, and it's easy. And the bird understands it. He's like, okay, cool. You're not going to touch me, and I can eat my nut over here totally comfortable from you. Change the papers and get out of here so I can be my bird. I'm going to be a bird. You know, I'm going to do my thing. I'm going to play with my toy and, you know, those kinds of things. The other thing that I think that people do is, and it's unfortunate, and I was a person who'd made lots of mistakes to find these things out, so I never want to come across as a know-it-all, be, you know, this is exactly what you should do, because I learned too. But I think a lot of the mistakes we make is to try to force a bird to do things we think they should be doing. In other words, if I go up to a cage and I say, hey, would you like to come out? And the bird's not wanting to come out. Don't make him come out. Leave him be. And a lot of times people think they have to have that bird come out of the cage. Oh, my God, he's got to come out of that cage. No, he doesn't.
Right, because they don't eat like dogs. Like a dog, you could throw a treat to a dog a billion times a day, and he's probably going to eat it. Well, they're usually, you know, they're larger animals. They have a larger stomach. And I was just thinking, too, that that it's a matter of perspective in it, where, you know, a bird is a smaller animal with a smaller stomach. And it's something you and I talked about earlier when I first had Maximus here, my blue and gold. I was chopping up, you know, big bowls of fruit and veggies and like, hey, buddy, here you go. You know, half a pound of fruit and vegetables. And he's eating two or three pieces and leaving the rest. And eventually I thought, oh, right, he's smaller and he's not going to have the appetite of a dog or a cat. Right. Of course, we don't usually train our cats, but I was kind of following you there on the, you know, baiting them with food. A bird is, you know, they eat like a bird. So they're not always going to want that treat, right?
Right. And that's such an important thing. A lot of people train their birds at the wrong time of day. And here's what I mean by that. They'll feed their birds. And then they'll go eat breakfast themselves, maybe. And then they'll come back and they'll go, okay, it's time to get trained, Tweety. And, you know, Tweety's full for the max. He doesn't care what you're, even if it's his favorite food, he may even not, you know, kind of look at you. It's like me going out for a steak dinner and having a cupcake afterwards. And then somebody else goes, oh, you really like that cupcake. I'm going to give you another one. And you're like, man, I'm telling you, I don't care what you give me. I'm not eating it. And that's the same thing we have to think about in perspective. If you feed them a full meal and then you expect them to train afterward using their favorite motivating treat, it's probably not going to happen.
Right.
So when you train your bird is essential. What I do here is I take my bird food and water away every night. And people go, oh, my God, how can you think about it? in the wild, is there a bird sitting up there with their food and water bowl all night long? No.
Exactly. They have to go find it. In the morning.
First thing,
and they're
the
not drinking all night long while they're sitting up in the tree. Right.
Yeah, you get it. And people usually get it when you explain it that way. It's like they don't need, and this is something, again, my avian vet. Now, of course, the caveat to everything I say like this is avian vet, and I can't stress that enough because certain birds have certain needs. Some birds, there are diabetic birds, there are certain birds that need their water. There are certain birds that are going to need that food all night long. But that's a minority, not the majority. So what I do is I remove the food and water every night. And that's it. It's gone. In the morning, I'm the one that brings you the food and water. Aren't you glad to see me then? Yes, you are.
Mm, another positive training issue. And we were listening, audience, what she's reminding me about in this part of this dialogue is that everything you do is training, right? Whether it's positive or negative, every action trains the bird some way.
Yes. And so thereby taking the food and water away at night, they're real happy to see me in the morning because they know I'm bringing food and water. And it's a real easy thing to do. Plus, I'm also getting rid of bacteria in that event, too. I mean, if we leave the water bowls in overnight, they're going to build bacteria overnight because the bird's not down there stirring that water bowl, you know, breaking up anything in there. There's usually food particles in the bowls. You don't want to leave that in there overnight. And why leave a food bowl in there? Just so that the first thing in the morning you uncover the bird or you wake the bird up, where do they go? To the food and water. No. You be the one that brings the food and water. You be the one. Give them breakfast in the morning.
And Maximus doesn't eat first thing in the morning. He just kind of eases into the day and he'll come out of his condo and climb up there and sit there and stretch his wings for a while, you know, and then he's kind of like, okay, I'm ready for Starbucks later, you know, but he doesn't eat right away.
And neither do we. We don't jump out of bed and the first thing we do is grab our,
slam down a big omelet or something.
So, you know, we have to put things in perspective of, and think about it from the bird's point of view too. If your food and water is there all the time, 24/7, there is no motivation for me, you know, to bring it to them and have them be happy. You know, switching out the food and water bowl on them. A lot of times I hear this, that birds are real possessive of their food and water bowl, and they get real nasty around that when you're trying to change it. You know, take the food and water bowl out. They try
to go
to the food
door. My conure does that. Yeah, when I take... I use water bottles myself. My birds drink out of water bottles, and I have a lot of reasons for that. I'm not going to get into because I'm more interested in what you do and why you do these things, how you work with your birds. So I'm not going to get into all my habits and listening audience. If you're new to keeping birds, it's different from bird to bird and situation to situation. Some people use big water bowls and some people use water bottles, and there's different reasons for that. But Mike Conyer, when you said that, I just was remembering my pineapple Conyer. If I take the water bowl out, whether it has any water in it or not, he starts screaming because he bathes in it. He takes a bath in it.
Yeah.
I have a water bottle that he drinks out of, but he loves to bathe. And I tell you, if there's water in that bowl, he'll bathe all day long, several times a day. Just loves it. And like you were saying, I think my habit, of taking a bowl out, putting some cool water in there, putting it back in. Okay, Sam, bath time. Every time I come and take it out, he starts yelling, screeching, because he knows it's bath time and he's excited. So I've trained him to do that in a way by doing that. But he loves it, and he that's one, I guess, example of dealing with a water bowl.
Absolutely. So I just like to do it that way, and the birds all know what's happening. So at night, I mean, my African gray is, I have one personal pet, and it's an African gray, and he coughs like crazy, picks up on everything. At night, when it's time for me to pull the water bowls, he starts, when he gets tired, he starts saying, time to go night-night, time to take your water, time to take your water, because he knows that's what we do.
So I want an African gray. That's my next bird. Because of the talking, I love the whistling. The whistling sound they do, I just love it. It's the coolest. They whistle so cool. It's the coolest sound.
They do a lot of stuff that's fun, but they also, you know, there's a caveat to every bird, and that is, you know, be careful. You never know what you're getting into, because he can also do, you know, the fire alarm, and he can do, you know, there's all the other stuff too. And his decibel level is way up there. But, you know, he knows that night. Yeah,
imitating the phone ringing and have you run into your phone all day long. And
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they have something like a 900-plus word phrase vocabulary potential listening audience. If you're new to this, we're just talking about the African gray. And I'm looking for my next bird is going to be an African gray. And because of their ability to talk, and I want to teach, you know, a bird to say some cool things. Max won't talk, so I'm hoping I can teach an African gray to talk, and maybe Max will start talking because he's jealous, something like that. I don't know. Max says about two words, and not very often. You know, so.
Well, one thing I do want to tell you, tell the listening audience too, and you as well. I've had African grays come and go from here as well. When I first started, I had not as many Senegals and wasn't so species-specific, and I had a lot of them at the same time, grays. But I'll tell you what, there have been a couple come through here that never have said a word. So you can't, it's not guaranteed that if you get an African gray, it's going to talk.
Right. So I'm going to get one that's already talking. Then I know. Yeah. Yes, and you know, that's a case with a lot of parrots. My studies, listening audience, I'm trying to think about everything I've read and studied in 30 years, but to me, it seems like probably more than half of the birds are not going to talk. So if you want a talker, it might be best to get one that's already talking, then you know. You might have a chance at getting them to say something you want them to say.
Right. Yeah, and that's something just to, you know, throw out there, because I know a lot of people want African grays because of the talking ability that they have, but not all of them will. So, you know, it's just like any other bird. Senegals talk too. I have some really awesome talkers here that do really well with verbalization and communication skills with talking, but I have a lot of others that never say a word, and some of them are the best behaved birds. So, you know, you just never know. I mean, you can't count on that being something that you can get as a species saying, I'm going to get an African gray because they talk, because they may not. It's just one of my things.
Right. What about flying? We were talking earlier about flying. You said you teach your birds to fly, and you like for your birds to have the ability to fly. Why is that? And what's your position on wing trimming, if you do any wing trimming at all?
Okay, so I have a lot to say on that, actually, because there's a lot of good stuff that I've learned recently, too. But let me talk about specific to the rescues here. All the birds here are fully flighted, fully feathered, so they're fully capable of flight, unless they have some kind of an issue that's physical. I have some here that pluck, that will do that probably for the rest of their lives, have came in that way, and that's the way they are, and they'll never fly. Some who have had damaged wings, and on and on. But those who are capable, who have maybe been clipped their whole life, and I have some that have come in their 20s, never knew how to fly, but were clipped, I allow them to grow their wings out, and I teach them to fly, and there's a couple reasons why. One is health. It is healthier for a bird to be able to use his lungs and his air sacs the way that they were intended to be used, and the only way they can be used really well is through flight. The other reason that I do it is because I want them to be safe with their flight and understand how to land and understand how to maneuver. And here's a good example. So I have a 20-year-old bird who comes in here. He didn't know how to fly because he was clipped his whole life. Maybe he never fledged properly because years ago they didn't do that. Now I think there's a changing trend out there, and there's more people, more breeders, who are allowing their birds to fledge at least before they're clipped the first time. But
what do you mean by fledging? I know what it means, but sure. Some people listening may not understand. Buddy Waske says that a lot, too, and I know what it means, but it may be a term that a lot of people kind of new to birdkeeping won't understand.
Okay, so fledging is when a baby bird is given the opportunity to learn to fly for the very first time. So in the wild, that's how they do it. They kick them out of the nest, or they just, you know, mom leaves and they have to follow. So they're going to flap their wings and they're going to try to fly, and they will learn. And that process can take a couple of days. In the wild, you'll see baby fledglings is what they're called, because they're learning to fly. They just fledged the nest. They just left the nest. And so they'll be on the ground for a few days trying to figure it out. And they will figure it out. They'll get the strength. We like to, now the trend is getting there, where people are starting to believe that fledging is the right thing to do. Let's let these birds fledge, really fly, understand how to fly before we take the flight away from them. It's good for them to understand how to use their wings so that later in life, if their wings do grow out or they change ownership and the new owner wants them to fly, their wings grow out, they know how to use it. They know how to land. They know how to not fly straight into the wall, or into the window, or into, you know, the ceiling fan, or whatever the case may be. Ceiling fans are a whole other issue. That was a bad example. You shouldn't have ceiling fans on, in my opinion, if your bird is out, regardless. But what we do here, I teach a bird that has never fledged to fly, even if he's in his 20s, by using a very simple method, and this will go back to the training issue I had mentioned, with motivation. So they will learn to hop from one perch to another. That hop then becomes a little wider gap because I'll move the perches farther apart. I'll move the perches far enough apart so that they have to hop and then flap a wing to get to the other one. So they're going back and forth for treats. Eventually that gap widens more and more to the point where they're flying from one place to another. I give that a name as well, so I'll tell them what they're doing. Go to perch. I learned this from Michael Stazin. It's very important that you give things names. And Michael Stazin is known as the parrot wizard, and I learned a lot of this stuff from him. But I'll tell you what, it's key to give it a name, too, and say go to perch or whatever. Because then when the bird's out flying around, I can say, go to perch, and he knows what I'm talking about. And he goes and lands on the perch. And if I have these perches around in my room, and a bird gets spooked later on after he's learned to fly, after I've taught a 20-some-year-old bird to fly, he's going to look for a perch to land on. Because now he remembers, oh, my gosh, all I have to do is go to perch. Yes, go to perch. You're fine.
A place of safety, right.
Yes, go to perch. Go to your perch. Just perch there. You're fine. So I have perches all over the place. And when a bird gets spooked, because it happens everywhere, you know, thunderbolts or whatever. That bird gets spooked and he starts flying around the room. They're skilled enough flyers at that point that they're not going to be bouncing off the wall. And they're going to look for a place to land because now they know how to land too. So teaching a bird to fly, in my opinion, affords them the ability to fly, to be a bird, to breathe properly, to have the exercise that they need, and to have the skill that they need to do it properly without being in an environment that's unsafe. Of course, you're going to make your environment safe. How do I mean that? You're going to have a ceiling fan turned off. You're going to have your doors and windows shut when your bird is out, and you're going to have places that they can land that are safe for them to land. That's all it takes. It's really easy. But you do have to be thoughtful about it. You have to put some thought into it. You have to make sure that it's a safe place, and you have to teach them. That's what we do here. Yes. Every bird here. Yep.
I wanted
to. All the birds learn. Yeah, they've all learned.
No, go ahead. I was.
No, that's all I was going to say. Is they've all learned. So they've all learned that there's a safety point. You know, I can land here. It's okay.
Okay. And listening audience, if you just joined us, I'm with Ginger of Ginger's Parrot Rescue, a 501c3 organization, nonprofit, bird rescue in Casa Grande, Arizona. And you can go to our podcast later. Actually, I think it's going to happen tomorrow because it's late tonight and I probably won't get this uploaded tonight. But you can go to our podcast later and listen to this entire conversation and benefit from all this great information with Ginger, who's been teaching us about a lot of behavior training. Of course, she's really good at rescuing birds, and they have a really great organization there, a great facility. But what I've noticed and what really attracted me and got me really interested in having Ginger on Bird Talk Live Online is that I think, in a nutshell, so to speak, this is what I would say is a full service bird rescue. Not saying others aren't, but this one definitely is. And they're taking birds in and preparing them to be adopted, socializing, behavior training. But this particular rescue is oriented to centigulls, cockatiels, and smaller birds. The training is the same for all birds that we're learning about with Ginger right now. And Ginger is a staff member with Oasis Sanctuary in Arizona, a Humane Society of Arizona partner. Also, an AFA certified aviculturist. It's American Federation of Aviculture. She's completed levels 1 and 2 of AFA certification in aviculture. 2012 graduate of Susan Friedman Behavior Works Program. So she's really done her homework. She's spent a lot of time practicing her education with birds and behavior training. And if you go back and listen to the show on the podcast, you're going to see that she has a lot of great solutions for all kinds of behavior problems. And it seems to be, it boils down to positive reinforcement training.
Got birds? Would you like to have veggies and fruits all year round for your feathered loved ones? Texas Natural Freeze-Dried Products produce chopped veggie and freeze-dried fruit foods for pet birds. No additives or preservatives. Healthy pets are happy pets. They can even help your picky eater. Go to TexasNaturalFreezeDried.com, place an order of $50 or more, and say you heard about this on Bird Talk Radio to receive a free gift. That's TexasNaturalFreezeDried.com.
I'm your host, Michael Kiger of Bird Talk Radio, recorded live from Kansas City. I hope you enjoy our premiere on the Voice America Variety Channel Saturdays at 3 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 p.m. Central, and 6 p.m. Eastern. Co-host Ginger Duplessis opens the door for listeners to become interested in and further their own study and practice of the force-free positive reinforcement pet bird training method. Visit birdtalkradio.com for more information, and thank you for tuning in today.